thinks maybe he is Narcissus after all, absorbed in vanity. But as he steps closer and more into the light, he can see the scars. He knew they were there, but to see them all at once is overwhelming. They are ugly, and they are everywhere. But nowhere are they more pronounced than on his face. That face is a nightmare. Strips of flesh, all different shades, like a living quilt stretched across the bone, muscle and cartilage beneath. Even his head, clean-shaven when he awoke, but now filling in with peach-fuzz hair, has different colors and textures sprouting like uneven fields of clashing crops. His eyes ache from the sight of himself, and tears cloud them.
"Why?"
is all he can think to say. He turns from his reflection, trying to disappear into his own shoulder, but Roberta gently touches that shoulder.
"Don't look away," she says. "Have the strength to see what I see."
He forces himself to look again, but all he can see are the scars.
"Monster,"
he says. That word comes from so many different bits of memory, he needs no help finding it.
"Frankenstein!"
"No," Roberta says sharply.
"Never think that. That monster was made from dead flesh, but you are made of the living. That creature was a violation of all things natural, but you, Cam, you are a new world wonder."
Now she looks into the mirror with him, pointing out his many miraculous parts.
"Your legs belong to a varsity runner," she tells him. "And your heart to a boy who could have been an Olympic swimmer, had he not been unwound. Your arms and shoulders once belonged to the best baseball player any harvest camp had ever seen. And your hands? They played guitar with rare and glorious talent."
Then she smiles and catches his gaze in the mirror.
"As for your eyes, they came from a boy who could melt a girl's heart with a single glance."
There is a certain pride in the way she speaks of him. It's a pride he cannot yet feel himself. Roberta puts a finger to his temple.
"But the best of it all is right in here."
She moves her finger around the multi-textured fuzz of his hair, pointing out different spots on his cranium, like travel destinations on a globe.
"Your left frontal lobe holds the analytical and computational skills of 7 kids who tested at the genius level in math and science. Your right frontal lobe combines the creative cores of almost a dozen poets, artists, and musicians. Your occipital lobe holds neuron bundles from countless unwinds with photographic memories. And your language center is an international hub of 9 languages, all waiting to be reawakened."
She touches his chin, turning him to face her. Her eyes, which seem so far away in the mirror, are now only inches from his. They are hypnotic and overpowering.
"Anata wa randamu doanai, Cam," she says. "Anata wa interigento nisake sarete imasu."
And Cam knows what she's saying. "You are not random, Cam. You are intelligently designed." He has no idea what language it is, but he knows what it means all the same.
"Every part of you was hand-picked from the best and the brightest," Roberta tells him. "And I was there at each unwinding, so you would see me, hear me, and know me once all the parts were united."
She takes a moment to think about it, and sadly shakes her head.
"Those poor kids were too dysfunctional to know how to use the gifts they were given. But now, even divided, they can finally be complete through you."
Now that she speaks of unwinding, fragments of memories flood him.
Yes, he had seen her, standing beside the operating table without as much as a surgical mask to cover her face,
because the point, he now realizes, was for her to be seen and remembered. But it wasn't just one operating room, was it? An identical memory, from dozens of different places in his mind. But it's not his mind, is it? It's their minds. All of them. Crying out, "Please, please make this stop." Until there is no voice to beg, no mind to scream, at that singular moment when I am becomes I'm not. He takes a deep, shuddering breath. Those final memories are a part of him now, spliced together, like the skin of his face. The memories are impossible to bear, and yet he bears them. Only now does he realize how strong he truly must be to hold the memory of 100 unwindings without crumbling to nothing. Roberta bids him to look around at the wealthy spoils of the cliffside mansion.
As you can see by your surroundings, we have very powerful backing to support you, so that you may continue to grow and prosper.
Backing? From who?
It doesn't matter who. They're friends. Not just your friends, but friends of a world we all want to live in.
And though it is all beginning to come together, his whole life beginning to slide into place, one thing still plagues him.
My face. It's horrible.
Not to worry, Roberta says. The scars will heal. In fact, the healing agents are already taking effect. Soon those scars will vanish completely, leaving the faintest of lines where the grafts meet. Trust me on this. I've seen the projection of what you will look like, Cam, and it is spectacular.
He traces his fingers along the scars on his face. They are not as random as he had thought. They are symmetrical, the different skin tones forming a pattern, a design.
It was a choice we made to give you a piece of every ethnicity, from the palest Sienna Caucasian to the darkest umber tones of unspoiled Africa, and everything in between. Hispanic, Asian, Islander, Native, Australoid, Indian, Semitic. A glorious mosaic of humanity. You are every man, Cam, and the truth of it is evident in your face. I promise you, when those scars heal, you will be the new definition of handsome. You will be a shining beacon, the greatest hope for the human race. You will show them that, Cam. By the mere virtue of your existence, you will show them.
As he thinks of this, his heart accelerates, pounding powerfully in his chest. He imagines all the races this heart of his has won, and although he has no memory of being a star swimmer, his heart knows what his mind does not. It longs to be in the pool once more, just as his legs long for the track. Right now, however, those legs buckle beneath him, and he finds himself on the ground, wondering how he got there.
Too much stimulation for one day, Roberta says.
The guards, who have been watching from the door, race in and help him up.
Are you all right, sir? Should we call for help, ma'am?
That won't be necessary. I'll tend to him.
They bring him to a plush sofa. He's shivering now, not just from the chill in the air, but from the revelation of knowing his own personal truth. Roberta grabs a throw blanket and covers him. She orders the room be made warmer, and she sits beside him like a mother comforting a feverish child.
There are big plans for you, Cam, but you don't have to worry about that now. Right now, all you have to do is build that amazing potential. Rope in all those parts of your mind that are still stray. Teach every part of your body to work in concert. You are the conductor of a living orchestra, and the music you're going to make will be beyond spectacular.
What if it's not?
He asks. Roberta leans over, kissing him gently on the forehead.
Simply not an option.
Advertisement.
When I lost my job, bills and debt began to pile up, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't think there was any way to provide for my family. I even thought about going to an offshore harvest facility and dividing myself on the black market to pay for my family's expenses. But the black market scared me. Well, at last there's a proposition on the ballot to legalize voluntary adult unwinding. Something that would provide my family with money enough to survive. Imagine that! I could enter the divided state with peace of mind, knowing my family would be provided for. And by legalizing it, the black marketers will be put out of business. Vote yes on Prop 58. Help families like mine. And put an end to parts pirateering.
paid for by the National Alliance of Donor Advocates.
Cam's dreams are always lucid. He always knows that he's dreaming, and until now his dreams have been a source of intense frustration. They don't follow dream logic. They don't follow any logic. They are disjointed, disconnected, and confused. Snippets of randomness strung together by the cobweb of his unconscious mind. His dreams feel like channel surfing through mental stations so quickly it's impossible to grasp the concept of any one thought bite. Maddening. However, now that he knows the nature of his being, Cam finds that he's able to ride the wave. Tonight, he dreams he's in a mansion. Not the one overlooking the ocean, but one in the clouds. As he moves from room to room, it's not just the decor that changes, but the world as well. Or rather, the life he's living within that world. In a kitchen, there are siblings he recognizes, sitting at a table, waiting for dinner. In a living room, a father asks him a question in a language that didn't make it into his brain, so he can't answer. And then there are the hallways, long hallways with rooms on either side, containing people he knows, but only slightly. These are rooms he will never enter, and those people will never be more than images trapped in those rooms. No further memory of them exists, or at least not within the cortical tissue he received. In each room and hallway he moves through, Cam feels an intense surge of loss, but it's balanced by the anticipation of the many rooms ahead. At the end of each dream, he finds a final door opening on a balcony with no railing. He stands at the edge, looking down into billowing clouds below, shredded and reformed by the forces of some sentient wind. Within him, 100 voices, the voices of those who are a part of him, all speak to him. But their many voices have blurred into an unintelligible rumble. Still, he knows what they're trying to tell him.
"Jump, Cam. Jump."
They're saying.
"Jump. Because we know you can fly."
In the morning, still high from the dream, Cam pushes himself harder than he ever had before in physical therapy. He feels the burn in his muscles now, rather than the strain on his healing wounds.
"You're at the top of your game today,"
Kenny tells him as he treats Cam's joints with a repeating cycle of ice and heat to speed the healing. Kenny, Cam has learned, was a top trainer for the NFL, but the powerful friends of whom Roberta spoke hired him to train a single client, offering him top dollar.
"Money talks,"
Kenny had to admit.
"Besides, it's not every day you get to be part of history in the making."
"Is that what I am?"
Cam thinks.
"Future history."
He tries to imagine the name Camus Composite Prime taught in future classrooms, but it doesn't stick. It's the name. It sounds too clinical, like the subject of an experiment rather than the result. He ought to shorten it. Camus Compri. The images of race cars speeding around a bend soars through his mind. The Grand Prix. That's it. Camus Compris. Silent S, silent X. A name that holds as many secrets as he. He grimaces as Kenny ices his shoulder, but today even that pain feels good.
"Bye, Marathon. No more basket,"
he says, then clears his throat and allows the thought to congeal, gathering the proper words.
"This marathon I'm on. Now it's as easy as pie. Not feeling wasted at all."
Kenny laughs.
"Didn't I tell you it'd get easier?"
This afternoon, Cam sits on the balcony with Roberta, and they're served lunch on silver trays. Each day, the foods have greater variety, but they're always in small portions. Shrimp cocktail, beet salad, chicken curry with couscous. All delicious challenges to his taste buds, sparking micro-memories and forcing neural connections to accompany his acute senses of taste and smell.
"All a part of your healing," Roberta tells him as they eat. "All a part of your growth."
After lunch, they sit for their daily ritual before the digital tabletop, taking in images to stimulate his visual memory. The images are more complicated now, nothing so easy as the Eiffel Tower or a fire truck. There are obscure works of art that Cam must identify,
if not the actual work, then at least the artist. Scenes from plays.
Who is the character?
Lady Macbeth.
What is she doing?
I don't know.
Then make something up. Use your imagination.
There are images of people in various walks of life, and Roberta asks Cam to imagine who they might be, what they might be thinking. Roberta doesn't allow him to speak until he has taken a moment to find the proper words.
Man on a train, wondering what's waiting at home for dinner. Probably chicken again. He's sick of chicken.
Then, amid the pictures strewn across the computer tabletop, Cam sees an image of a girl that catches his attention. Roberta follows his eyes to the image, and she immediately tries to wipe the image away, but Cam grabs her hand and stops her.
No! Let me see!
Reluctantly, Roberta takes her hand from the image. Cam drags it toward him, rotates it, and enlarges it. He can tell the picture was not taken with the girl's permission. It's framed at an odd angle, perhaps taken secretly. A memory flashes. This same girl, on a bus.
That picture is not supposed to be here, Roberta says. Can we move on now?
Not yet.
Cam can't quite tell where the picture was taken. It's outdoors, dusty. The girl plays a piano under something dark and metallic that shades her. The girl is beautiful.
Clipped wings, broken heaven.
Cam closes his eyes, remembering Roberta's order that he find the proper words before he speaks.
She's like an angel damaged when she fell to earth. She plays music to heal herself, but nothing can heal her brokenness.
Very nice,
says Roberta unconvincingly. On to the next one. Roberta reaches over and tries to drag the picture away, but Cam slides it to his corner of the table, out of her reach.
No. Stays here.
The fact that Roberta is bothered by this just makes Cam more curious.
Who is she?
Nobody important.
But clearly from Roberta's reaction, she is.
I will meet her.
Roberta chuckles bitterly.
Very unlikely.
We'll see.
They get on with their mental exercises, but Cam's mind stays on the girl. Someday, he will find out who she is and meet her. He will learn everything he needs to know, or, more accurately, unify and organize all the things that are already there in his fragmented brain. Once he does, he'll be able to speak to this girl with confidence. And then, in his own words, and in whatever language he needs to, he'll be able to ask her why she looks so sad, and what unfortunate twist of fate has left her in a wheelchair. Part 2. Holies. 34 Children Abandoned Under Nebraska's Safe Haven Law. By Nate Jenkins, The Associated Press. Friday, November 14th, 2008. Lincoln, Nebraska, AP. Nebraska officials geared up Friday for a special legislative session designed to deal with a unique safe haven law, whose unintended consequences have allowed parents to abandon nearly 36 children as old as 17. As the session to correct the law approached, a 5-year-old boy was dropped off at an Omaha hospital on Thursday night. Earlier in the day, a woman dropped off 2 teenagers at another Omaha hospital, but one of them, a 17-year-old girl, fled. Authorities have not found her yet. As of Friday afternoon, 34 children had been abandoned under the Nebraska law, 5 of them from other states. Nebraska was the last state to enact a safe haven law, intended to take in unwanted newborns. But unlike laws in other states, Nebraska's doesn't include an age limit. Some observers have interpreted the current law as applying to children as old as 18. The full article can be found at https://articles.nydailynews.com/2008-11-14 https://news/179106664_1_safe-haven-law-omaha-hospital-unique-safe-haven-law. 4. Parents. There together as they open the door, a father and mother dressed for bed. Worry lines fill their foreheads as they see the nature of their visitors. This is an anticipated yet unexpected moment. A juvie cop stands at the door with three plainclothes officers to back him up. The lead juvie cop is young. They all seem young. They recruit them earlier and earlier these days. We're here to process unwind subject 53-990-24. Noah Falkowski. The parents glance at each other in alarm.
You're a day early,
the mother says. The schedule's been pushed up, the lead cop tells her. We have the contractual right to change the pickup date. Can we please have access to the subject? The father takes a step forward to look at the name on the officer's uniform.
Look here, Officer Mullard,
he says in a loud whisper.
We're not prepared to surrender our son just yet. As my wife has told you, we were expecting you tomorrow. You have to come back then.
But E. Robert Mullard waits for no one. He barges into the house, with his team following behind him.
Good God,
the father says.
Have some decency.
Mullard lets out a guffaw.
Ha! Decency! What do you know about decency?
Then he looks down the bedroom hallway.
Noah Falkowski, he calls loudly. If you're back there, come out now.
A 15-year-old boy peeks out of a bedroom doorway, takes one look at the guests, and slams his door. Mullard signals to the brawniest of his cohorts.
He's all yours.
I'm on it.
Stop him, Walter!
The woman begs her husband. Walter, put on the spot, turns to Mullard with a vengeance.
I want to talk to your superior.
And then Mullard pulls out a gun. You're in no position to make demands. It's clearly just a trank pistol, but considering that nasty business about the juvie cop killed with his own gun, Walter and his wife aren't about to take any chances.
Sit down,
Mullard says, nodding toward the dining room. The couple hesitates.
I said sit down!
And then two of Mullard's team force them to sit in two dining room chairs. The father, a reasonable man, assumes he's dealing with another reasonable young professional like himself.
Is this all really necessary, Officer Mullard?
He asks in a calmer, more accommodating tone. My name isn't Mullard, and I'm not a juvie cop. Suddenly it hits the man how obvious this is. He knew this kid was too young to have that kind of authority. The scars on his face made him seem a little, well, seasoned. But still, he was too young. How could Walter have been so easily fooled? And isn't there something familiar about this young man's face? Has he seen him before? Possibly in the news? The man is rendered speechless by this unexpected turn of non-professional events. 5. Connor. The best part of these missions is the look on the parents' faces when they realize that the tables have been turned. How their eyes dart down toward the trank gun aimed at them, suddenly realizing that their unwind order is now nothing but a piece of paper.
Who are you?
Asks the father.
What is it you want?
We want what you no longer want, Connor tells him. We want your son. Then Trace, the muscular team member he sent after Noah, comes out of the bedroom holding the struggling kid.
They don't make bedroom locks like they used to, Trace says.
Let me go!
Shouts the kid.
Let me go!
Connor goes to him while Hayden, also on the rescue team, pulls a trank gun to make sure the couple doesn't get any ideas.
Noah, your parents were about to unwind you, Connor tells him. In fact, the juvies are coming tomorrow. But luckily for you, we came first.
There's a horrified look on the kid's face. He shakes his head, denying the possibility.
You're lying!
Then he looks to his parents, not so sure anymore.
He's lying, right?
Connor doesn't let the parents answer.
The truth. You owe him that much.
You have no right to do this,
the mother yells.
The truth, demands Connor.
Then the father sighs and says,
yes, what he says is true. I'm sorry, Noah.
Now Noah casts a furious gaze at his parents and then turns to Connor. Connor can see tears building behind his fury.
Are you going to hurt him?
Noah asks. Do you want me to?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Connor shakes his head.
Sorry. That's not what we do. Someday you'll be grateful we didn't.
Noah looks down.
No, I won't.
Trace, no longer having to hold Noah quite so tightly, escorts him back to his bedroom so Noah can shove a few things into his backpack, what little he can salvage from 15 years of life. While the rest of Connor's team checks out the home, making sure there is no one else present to call the police or otherwise foul up the mission, Connor hands a pad and pen to the father.
What's this for?
You're going to write down the reasons you decided to have your son unwound.
What's the point?
We know you have reasons for doing it, Connor says.
I'm sure they're stupid.
I'm sure they're selfish and seriously screwed up, but they're still reasons. If nothing else, it'll help us to know what kind of pain in the ass Noah is, so maybe we can deal with him better than you did.
You keep saying we,
the mother asks.
Who's we?
We're the ones saving your son's freaking life. That's all you need to know.
The father looks down pitifully at the little notepad.
Right, Connor says.
Neither he nor the mother look up as Trace escorts Noah out of the house into the waiting car.
I hate you,
he yells back at them.
I never meant it when I said it before, but now I do.
Connor can tell it cuts deeply into these parents, but not as deeply as the scalpels of a chop shop.
Someday, if he makes it to 17, he may give you a shot at forgiveness. If he does, don't throw that chance away.
They say nothing to that. The father just looks down at the pad, scribbling and scribbling. When he's done, he hands it back to Connor. Rather than a manifesto, the man has written down his excuses in efficient bullet points. Connor reads them out loud, as if each one was an accusation against them.
Disrespect and disobedience.
Those are always the first reasons. If every parent unwound a kid due to disrespect, the human race would go extinct in a single generation.
Destructive behavior to self and property.
Connor knows a bit about self-destructive behavior and did his share of vandalizing in times of frustration. But most kids get over that, don't they?
It never ceases to amaze him how everything, even unwinding, is geared toward the quick fix.
Connor looks at the third bullet point and has to laugh.
Lack of personal hygiene?
The woman throws her husband an angry gaze for writing that.
Oh, I like this one, Connor says. Diminished prospects for future. Sounds like a stock report.
At every rescue mission, Connor reads aloud the reasons, and each time he wonders if it's the same list his parents would have written. This time, the last reason chokes Connor up a bit.
Our own failure as parents.
And then he gets mad at himself. These parents haven't earned his sympathy. If it's their failure, then why should their son have to pay for it?
Tomorrow, when the juvie rounders come for him, you'll tell him that he ran away. And you don't know where he went. You won't talk about us or what happened here today, because if you do, we'll know. We monitor all the police frequencies. And if we don't comply?
The father asks, showing the same kind of disobedience he condemned his son for.
In case you have any thought of reporting this, we've uploaded a nice identity cocktail for the two of you onto the net.
That makes them both look even more ill than they already do.
What kind of cocktail?
Hayden's the one who answers, proud because it was his idea.
We send out a single code over the net, and bingo! Your names become linked to a dozen known clapper cells. Your digital footprint will be so tangled in terrorism, you'll spend years trying to get Homeland Security off your collective asses.
The couple nod a solemn acceptance.
Fine,
the man says.
You have our word.
The threat of identity cocktails is always very effective. And besides, whether these kids go with Connor or they're unwound, the parents get what they want. Their unmanageable kid becomes somebody else's problem. Reporting Connor and his team would just make Noah their problem again.
You have to understand, we were desperate,
says the mother with a high quotient of self-righteousness.
Everyone told us that unwinding was the best thing to do. Everyone.
Connor tears up the list of excuses and drops it on the floor, locking eyes with her.
So, in other words, you decided to unwind your son because of peer pressure?
Finally, the two of them crumble, feeling the appropriate weight of shame. The father, who had started out so defiant, suddenly bursts into tears. It's the mother who holds it together enough to offer Connor one last excuse.
We tried to be good parents, but there's a point at which you give up trying.
No, there's not, Connor tells her. Then he turns to go, leaving them with the worst punishment of all, having to live with themselves. Connor and his team drive off in an intentionally nondescript minivan with a false license plate. Noah Falkowski is understandably grim as he looks out the window, watching his neighborhood go by for the last time. He doesn't seem to know who they are. He doesn't seem to care. Connor's glad Noah doesn't recognize him. While the Akron AWOL has a legendary reputation in some circles, his face was in the news much less than Lev's. Plus, with everyone thinking he's dead, it's easier to go incognito.
Relax! Connor tells him. You're among friends.
I got no friends,
says Noah. And for now, Connor lets him feel sorry for himself. The graveyard is true to its name this late at night. Airplane tail fins stand as monumental and as quiet as tombstones. Kids are on watch patrol with trank-loaded rifles. But other than that, there's no sign that the place is home to more than 700 AWOL unwinds.
So why are we here?
Noah asks as the rescue party pulls down the main aisle, the busiest street of the graveyard, flanked by a series of large aircraft that make up the core of their living space, each one named by unwinds who have long since left. Names like Crash Mama, for one of the main girls' dorms, the Com Bomb, a veteran World War II bomber that's become their computer and communications center. And, of course, IHOP, the International House of Purgatory, where new arrivals like Noah stay until they're given a job and integrated into the graveyard.
The graveyard's where you live until you turn 17, Connor tells Noah.
Like hell I will,
the kid says. Typical. Connor just ignores him.
Hayden, get him a bedroll and escort him to IHOP. We'll see what kind of work he's suited for in the morning.
So what am I, a stinking AWOL now?
Asks Noah.
AWOLs is what they call us,
says Hayden.
We call ourselves holies. As to whether or not you stink, I think we can all agree that you need to visit our bathing facilities at your earliest possible convenience.
The kid grunts like a mildly irritated bull, and Connor grins. It was Hayden who actually came up with the term holies, because unwind and AWOL were negative labels put on them by the world.
You should be a spin doctor,
Connor told Hayden, to which he facetiously replied,
spinning makes me nauseous. I'd puke on my patients.
Hayden, Connor, and Risa were the only three holies remaining who had been harbored in Sonia's safe house way back when. That experience bonded them as if they were lifelong friends. Noah toddles off with Hayden to the International House of Purgatory, and Connor takes a few moments to enjoy some rare peace and quiet. He looks to ACMAC, the jet where Risa sleeps. The lights are out, just like the others, but he suspects she has already peered out at the sound of their approach to make sure that Connor has arrived home safe and sound.
I'm not sure if these missions of yours are noble or stupid,
Risa once told him.
Why can't they be both? He responded. The fact is, saving individual kids is somehow far more satisfying for him than the daily ins and outs of running the graveyard. These side trips keep him sane.
When he was left in charge, it was only supposed to be temporary. The anti-divisional resistance was supposed to find a suitable replacement for the Admiral, someone who could present an image that the public could believe would be running an airplane salvage operation. But then they realized that they didn't need that. They had people in the graveyard's front office, a trailer near the entrance, and those employees ran the business end of things. As long as Connor kept the kids working, fed, and quiet, the ADR found no reason to hire someone else.
Surveying your domain?
Connor turns to see Trace coming up to him.
It's not mine. I only work here, Connor tells him. The new kid settled in?
Yeah, a real complainer. He says the blanket's too rough.
He'll get over it. We all do.
Trace Neuhauser is an Air Force buff who gave it up to join the resistance when his sister was unwound. He's AWOL from his unit for 6 months now, but still a buff in every sense of the word. He's all steroid bulk, with a tunnel vision education in the martial sciences. Connor never liked buffs, maybe because they know their purpose in the world and generally serve it well. Seeing them always made Connor feel useless. That a buff has become such a close friend proves that people change. Trace is 23, but seems to have no problem taking orders from a 17-year-old.
Chain of command knows no age restrictions, he once told Connor. You could be 6, but if you're my superior, I'd still do as I was told.
Maybe that's why Connor likes him. Because if a guy like that can respect Connor's lead, maybe he's not such a lousy leader after all. The next day begins, as every day begins in the graveyard, with things to be done. The firefighter's treadmill, the Admiral called it, and endless trot to stomp out nuisances.
Leadership is about keeping toilets flushing, the Admiral once said. Unless you're on the battlefront. Then it's about staying alive. Neither are pleasant.
On the main aisle, kids are already lounging beneath the recreation jet, watching TV or playing video games. Still more have begun their shifts, dismantling or rebuilding aircraft parts, as per the orders coming in from the front office. Sometimes it's easier for Connor to think that it's all going on in spite of him, rather than because of him. As soon as Connor is spotted on the main aisle, the barrage begins.
Hey, Connor, says a kid, running up to him. Not to complain, but, like, can we get some better food here? I mean, I know beggars can't be choosers and all, but if I gotta eat beef-flavored stew with no actual beef in it one more time, I think I'm gonna hurl.
Yeah, you and everyone else, Connor tells him.
Mr. Akron?
Says a girl, 14 or so. He can't get over the fact that so many of the kids, particularly the younger ones, are not only ridiculously respectful, but think that Akron is somehow part of his name.
I don't know if you know this, but the fans in Crash Mama ain't working no more, and it's way too hot at night.
I'll send someone to fix them, Connor tells her. Then a third kid comes up complaining that there's too much trash, and can't he do something about it?
I swear, half the time I feel like a janitor, he tells Trace. I need a dozen more hands just to keep this place afloat.
You do have a dozen hands, Trace reminds him. But you gotta be willing to use them.
Yeah, yeah, says Connor, having heard it before. He shouldn't be mad at Trace for pointing these things out. After all, that's why he keeps Trace so close, to advise him on how to be in charge.
Connor has already accepted the odd reality that he's some sort of leader. But, as the Admiral pointed out, it's a pretty thankless job. After the Admiral left him in charge, Connor had set up a power structure, an inner circle, an outer circle, and everyone else. Those in his inner circle are supposed to make sure things like food supplies and sanitation are being taken care of, because Connor has much more pressing things to deal with, things like keeping them all in one piece.
I'll call a meeting after I meet with the rep from the Resistance, Connor tells Trace. And I'll make sure tasks are being delegated.
Maybe, says Trace. You need to take a look at who you're delegating to.
Connor never knew he could handle this kind of responsibility, but now that he knows, he wishes he could go back to just being responsible for himself. There are so many things he feels he still needs to do. Thanks to Lev and his misguided clapper cell, Connor avoided being unwound, but he still doesn't feel entirely whole. 6. Risa. There is only one permanently disabled resident of the graveyard. Since the disabled are a protected class, they're never at risk for being unwound, so they never turn up at the graveyard with all the other kids who ran from their unwind order. It's a testimony to the Swiss cheese nature of public compassion. Lucky for those to whom grace is extended, but unlucky for those who wind up in the holes. Risa is disabled by choice. That is to say, she refused surgery that would repair her severed spine, because it involved giving her the spine of an unwound kid. It used to be that spinal damage was irreversible, and if that was the card you were dealt, you spent the rest of your days with it. She wonders if it's harder to live like that, or to live knowing you can be fixed, but choose not to. Now she lives in an old McDonnell Douglas MD-11, for which they built a wooden switchback ramp to the main hatch. The plane has been aptly named Accessible Mac, or ACMAC for short. There are about 10 kids with sprained ankles or other temporary conditions who currently share ACMAC with Risa, each in sections divided by curtains, providing the illusion of personal space. Risa has the old first-class cabin of the jet, which is forward of the hatch. It gives her a larger living area, but she can't stand the fact that it singles her out. The whole lousy jet singles her out. And although her shattered spine is a well-earned war wound, it doesn't change the fact that she is constantly condemned to receive special treatment. The only other plane with a ramp is the infirmary jet, where she works. It leaves Risa with a very limited choice of interior spaces, so she spends her free time outside when she can stand the heat. Every day at 5 o'clock, Risa waits for Connor beneath a stealth bomber they've nicknamed Hush Puppy. Every day, Connor is late. The bomber's expansive black wings create a huge wedge of shade, and its radar-resistant skin wicks heat right out of the air. It's one of the coolest spots in the graveyard, in more ways than one. She finally sees him approaching, a figure in blue camo that sets him apart from anyone else in the graveyard.
"I thought you weren't coming,"
Risa says as he reaches the shade of Hush Puppy. "I was supervising an engine dismantling."
"Yeah,"
says Risa with a grin.
"That's what they all say."
Connor brings his tension with him to these daily encounters with her. He says being with her is the only time he gets to feel normal, but he never truly relaxes. In fact, since she first met him, she's never known him to relax. It doesn't help to know that their legends are out there, living lives of their own. Stories of Connor and Risa have already grown deep roots in modern folklore. For few things are more compelling than an outlaw romance. They are Bonnie and Clyde for a new era, the subjects of bumper stickers and T-shirts. Hard to imagine that so much notoriety came from merely surviving the blast at Happy Jack Harvest Camp, merely because Connor was lucky enough to be the first unwind ever to walk out of a chop shop in one piece. Of course, as far as the rest of the world knows, Connor died there, and Risa is missing, either dead herself or in hiding deep within some AWOL-friendly nation, if there even is such a thing anymore. She wonders how her legend would hold up if people knew she was right here in the Arizona desert, sunburned and dirty. A breeze blows beneath Hush Puppy's belly, getting even more dirt in Risa's eyes. She blinks it away. "Are you ready?" Connor asks her.
"Always."
Then Connor kneels before Risa's wheelchair and begins to massage her legs, trying to coax circulation to those parts of her that can no longer feel. It's part of their daily ritual together, this physical contact between them. It's coolly clinical, yet strangely intimate at the same time. Today, however, Connor is detached, distant.
"Something's bothering you even more than usual,"
Risa says. A statement of fact, not a question.
"Go on, spill it."
Connor sighs, looks up at her, and asks the big question.
"Why are we here, Risa?"
She considers the question.
"Do you mean, why are we here philosophically, as a species?
Or why are we here doing this in full view of anyone who cares to watch?
Let them watch, he says. I don't care. And clearly he doesn't, because privacy is the first casualty when you live in the graveyard. Even the small private jet Connor claimed as his quarters has no curtains on its windows. No, Risa knows that this has nothing to do with their daily ritual, or the grand question of humanity. It has to do with survival.
What I mean is, why are we still here in the graveyard? Why haven't the juvies tranked and yanked us all?
You said it yourself. They don't see us as a threat.
But they should, Connor points out. They're not stupid, which means that there's some other reason why they haven't taken this place down.
Risa reaches over, rubbing Connor's tense shoulder.
You think too much.
Connor smiles at that. When you met me, you accused me of not thinking enough.
Well, your brain is making up for lost time.
After what we've been through, after what we've seen, can you blame me?
I like you better as a man of action.
Action has to be well thought out. You taught me that. Risa sighs.
Yes, I suppose I did. And I created a monster.
She realizes that both of them have been profoundly changed in the wake of the Happy Jack Harvest Camp revolt. Risa likes to think that their spirits have been galvanized like iron in a furnace, but sometimes it feels like they've only been damaged by those harsh flames. Still, she's glad she had survived to see the far-reaching effects of that day, like Cap 17. Even before Happy Jack, there had been a bill in Congress calling for the lowering of the legal limit of unwinding by a whole year, to one's 17th birthday instead of 18th. The Cap 17 bill had never been expected to pass. In fact, most people didn't even know about it until Happy Jack made the news, and until poor Lev Calder's face became plastered on the cover of every major magazine, the innocent boy clothed all in white, a bright-eyed, clean-cut kid smiling out from a school picture. How the perfect child became a clapper was a question that made parents everywhere stop and take notice. Because if it could happen to Lev, who's to say that their own child might not turn their blood explosive someday and detonate themselves in a burst of rage? And the fact that Lev chose not to detonate himself troubled people even more, because they couldn't just file him away as a bad seed. They had to accept that he had a soul, a conscience, which meant that maybe society had a hand in making him a clapper. And then, suddenly, as if to assuage everyone's feelings of cultural guilt, the Cap 17 bill became law. No one could be unwound after their 17th birthday.
You're thinking about Lev again, aren't you? Connor asks.
How do you know?
Because whenever you do, time stops, and your eyes go to the dark side of the moon.
She reaches down to touch his hands, which has stopped massaging, and he gets back to coaxing her troubled circulation.
It's because of him that the Cap 17 law passed, you know,
Risa says.
I wonder how he feels about that.
I'll bet it gives him nightmares.
Or,
suggests Risa,
maybe he sees the bright side of it.
Do you?
Connor asks. Risa sighs.
Sometimes.
Cap 17 should have been a good thing, but in time it became clear that it was not. Sure, it was a victorious morning that next day, when the news showed thousands of 17-year-olds being released from harvest camps. It was a triumph of human compassion, and a great victory for those against unwinding. But that same feeling of victory allowed people to turn a blind eye again to the whole problem. Unwinding was still there, but people could now look the other way, believing their consciences were clean. And then came the media blitz, a flood of advertisements designed to remind people how much better things were since the Unwind Accord. Unwinding, the natural solution, the ad said. Or, troubled teen, love them enough to let them go. And, of course, Risa's favorite, experience a world outside of yourself. Embrace the divided state. The sad truth about humanity, Risa was quick to realize, is that people believe what they're told. Maybe not the first time, but by the 100th time, the craziest of ideas just becomes a given. Which brings her back to Connor's question.
With a major shortage of unwinds in the system after Cap 17, and a public accustomed to getting all the parts they want whenever they want them, why hasn't the graveyard been raided? Why are they still here?
We're here,
Risa tells him.
Because we are. And we should just be thankful for that while it lasts.
Then she gently touches his shoulder, signaling it's time to end the massage.
I'd better get back to the infirmary, Jet. I'm sure there are plenty of scrapes, black eyes, and fevers to take care of. Thank you, Connor.
As many times as he does this for her, she's always embarrassed that she needs it. He rolls down the loose-fitting legs of her khaki pants and puts her feet back on the wheelchair's footrests.
Never thank a guy for putting his hands all over you.
Not all over,
Risa says coyly. Connor throws her a sly little grin, letting it carry the weight of anything he might have said to that.
I think I'd like our times together even more,
she tells him,
if you were actually here.
Connor reaches up to touch her face, but he stops himself, switches hands, and touches her with the left instead of the right, the one he was born with.
I'm sorry. It's just your brain making up for lost time, I know. But I do look forward to a day we can be together and not be filled with all these dark thoughts. Then we'll know we've won.
Then she pushes off toward the infirmary jet, maneuvering over the rugged ground on her own, as always, refusing to be pushed by anyone, ever. 7. Connor. A representative from the Anti-Divisional Resistance shows up the next afternoon. 3 days late for his scheduled meeting with Connor. He's disheveled, paunchy, and drenched in sweat.
And it's not even summer, Connor says, hoping to make the point that the sweltering Arizona summer is just a few months away.
The ADR had better get their act together, or there are going to be a lot of angry AWOLs. That is, the ones who survive the heat. They meet in the retired Air Force One, which used to be the Admiral's personal quarters, but now serves only as a conference room. The man introduces himself as Joe Rincon.
But call me Joe. No formalities in the ADR.
He sits at the conference table and pulls out a pad and pen to take notes. He's already glancing at his watch, as if there's somewhere else he would rather be. Connor has a whole list of gripes from every corner of the graveyard. Why are the food shipments so few and far between? Where are the medical supplies they requested? How about air conditioner and generator parts? Why are they not being warned when planes show up with new arrivals? And for that matter, why are the numbers coming in so light? 5 or 10 at a time, when the planes used to come in with 50 or more. With food supply being a constant issue, Connor doesn't mind the low numbers, but it troubles him. If fewer AWOLs are being found by the Resistance, that means the juvies, or worse, the so-called parts pirates, must be finding them first.
What's wrong with you people? Why does the ADR keep ignoring all our requests?
There's really nothing to worry about,
Rincon says, which sends up a red flag for Connor, because he never said anything about being worried.
Things are still being reorganized.
Still? No one ever told us things were being reorganized at all. And what do you mean by reorganized?
Rincon blots his sweaty forehead with his shirt sleeve.
Really, there's nothing to worry about.
Over the course of a year, Connor has come to understand the Anti-Divisional Resistance better than he wanted to. When he was just an AWOL, he had no choice but to trust that the ADR was a well-oiled rescue machine. But it was nothing of the sort. The only thing that ran smoothly was the graveyard. The Admiral had made sure of that, and Connor, following in his footsteps, keeps it that way. He should have realized things with the ADR were not as they appeared as soon as they accepted the Admiral's suggestion that Connor be the one to run the place, rather than installing a more experienced adult. If they were so willing to let a teenager manage their AWOL sanctuary, something was wrong somewhere. There was a crazy time when kids were coming in every few days. The graveyard boasted more than 2,000 kids, and the ADR sent shipments of everything they needed on a regular basis. Then, when Cap 17 passed, Connor was ordered to immediately release all the 17-year-olds, who were a large percentage of the graveyard population. but he made a command judgment to do it slowly, releasing them in increments, so they didn't flood the city of Tucson with more than 900 homeless teenagers. The fact that they wanted him to just let all those kids go at once should have been another sign that the ADR leadership was faltering. Connor had released them over a period of 2 months, but the ADR cut their supplies immediately, as if those kids had suddenly ceased to be their problem. Between the released 17-year-olds, kids sent out on work programs that had been set in place by the Admiral, and kids who deserted when there wasn't enough food, the graveyard population had dropped to about 700.
"I see you've planted yourself quite a garden, and you're raising chickens as well, yes?"
Rincon says.
"You must be fully sustainable by now."
"Not even close. The Green Isle produces only about one-third of the food that we need, and with the ADR flaking on our food shipments, we've had to resort to raiding market delivery trucks in Tucson."
"Oh, dear,"
says Rincon. That's all, just,
"Oh, dear,"
and he starts to gnaw on the end of his pen. Connor, whose patience has been frayed since day one, is tired of beating around the bush.
"Are you going to tell me something useful, or are you just here to waste my time?"
Rincon sighs.
"It comes down to this, Connor. We believe the graveyard has been compromised."
Connor cannot believe what this fool is telling him.
"Of course it's been compromised. I'm the one who told you it was compromised. The juvies know about us, and since the day I took over, I've been saying we need to relocate."
"Yes, we're working on that. But in the meantime, we can't keep pouring valuable resources into a facility that could be taken out by the juvies at any moment."
"So you're just going to let us rot here?"
"I didn't say that. You seem to have everything under control. With any luck, the juvies will never find a need to invade."
"With any luck?"
Connor stands and storms from the table.
"The resistance should be about action, not luck. But do you take action? No! I send you my plans to infiltrate harvest camps and ideas on how to free kids in nonviolent ways that won't piss people off and create a backlash. But all I hear from the ADR is, 'We're working on it, Connor,' or 'We'll take it under advisement, Connor.' And now you're telling me to rely on luck for our survival? What the hell is the ADR good for?"
Rincon takes this as his cue to end the meeting, something he's clearly wanted to do since the moment he arrived.
"Hey, I'm just a messenger. Don't take this out on me."
But there are some things Connor simply cannot help, and he finds himself swinging Roland's fist at Call Me Joe Rincon's face. The punch connects with the man's eye, and he stumbles backward into the bulkhead. He looks at Connor not with contempt, but with fear, as if Connor might not stop there. So much for nonviolence. Connor backs off.
"There's my message," he says. "Please, take it back to the people who sent you."
There's a wingless Boeing 747 airliner that has been gutted, like just about every other plane in the graveyard, and retrofitted with gym equipment. It's been named Jimbo, although some call it the fight deck, since so many brawls seem to break out there. This is where Connor goes to get out his frustrations. A big punching bag before him, he pounds it like a prize fighter hell-bent on a first-round knockout. He imagines the faces of all the kids who pissed him off that day, all the ones who have excuses for not doing what they're supposed to do, and he spreads his anger further to people like Rincon and the juvie cops that he's had to face, to the smiling counselors at the harvest camp who tried to make unwinding seem like a wholesome, family-friendly activity, and finally to the faces of his parents, who set in motion the clockwork that landed him here. For them, he can't hit that bag hard enough, and yet can't stomach the guilt he feels for feeling that way. The punches from his left hand are nothing compared to those from his right. He looks at the shark tattoo staring at him from the forearm, that tiger shark even uglier than the real thing. He has to admit to himself that he's gotten used to it, but he'll never like it. The color of the hair that grows on that arm is also thicker and darker than that of his other arm.
"He's here," Connor tells himself. "Roland is here with every punch I throw with his hand."
And the worst part about it is that throwing those punches feels good, as if the arm itself is enjoying it. He moves toward a bench press, and a couple of kids who had been sharing it make way for him, a perk of being in charge. He looks at the weight, adds another 5 pounds on either side, then leans back, ready to pump. Every day he does this, and every day this is the part he hates the most, because nowhere is the difference between his left arm and his right clearer than on the bench press. The arm he was born with struggles to raise that bar, and suddenly he realizes that even now he's still fighting Roland.
"Need someone to spot you?"
says a kid behind him. Connor tilts his neck to see standing above him the kid everyone just calls Starkey.
"Yeah, sure," says Connor. "Thanks."
He goes for another set, already feeling his natural arm aching, but not wanting to give in to it. But after 7 reps, it starts